This is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know the drill, recording on Monday morning. We begin today's show with a political poem by Lynn Ekdahl. Lynn Ekdahl is the wife of one of our regular guests, a former CIA operative named Mel Goodman. They actually met, I think, in the CIA, which is kind of cool. So Lynn is old like me, and now in her old age, she writes political poetry as a form of therapy, I think. But this one is so totally perfect for our first guest. It's entitled Praying Mantis, Ron DeSantis, and it's P-R-E-Y-I-N-G, okay, just to make sure. Poor Florida possesses its own praying mantis, its governor, the insidious Ronald DeSantis. He pretends to be caring, a sensitive human, as he seeks to seduce the people he's grooming. He hopes to attach his own little wagon to the folks who are part of the cult that is Magin. His hope and his longing, so clear in his eyes, is to be our next president. Hence the disguise. Into the landscape he carefully blends, cajoling and wooing all possible friends. He lurks and he waits till the moment is right. Then he springs into action, prepared for the fight. He proved how depraved he is and also how mean when he disparaged, maligned the COVID vaccines. How many Floridians went on to die because of DeSantis's outrageous lies? Then he went after teachers, LGBTQ, books and librarians, colleges too. Don't teach our kids history for they might feel guilt. As if faced with history, our children will wilt. But let them face crazies with AR-15s. Teach them hide under the desk, active shooter routines. DeSantis asserts that all guns need protection. That's how he intends to prevail in elections. He'll outright the Donald on various fronts. That shouldn't be hard because the Donald's a dunce. But if the mantis prevails next electoral day, why, we all will become Ron DeSantis's prey. What a toxic poem, but what an interesting poem. This was not planned, Anna. I actually reached out to you before I got this regular political poem. So let me explain to you what we're about to do. We're going to have a conversation with Tallahassee Democrat reporter Anna Goni Lesson. She wrote a piece at the Tallahassee Democrat entitled Florida Department of Education Investigation of Leon's Rocky Hannah. Hannah is under a preliminary investigation by the State Education Department for allegedly infusing, quote, personal views into his work as the head of the school district. And not only do I want to welcome Anna, but she's got an incredible resume. How did they score you is what I want to know. She covers the Tallahassee Democrats Children and Families reporter. She is a Tallahassee native, was formerly the Houston Chronicle's assistant op-ed editor. Listen to this, KPFT. Anna specialized in coverage of minority communities in Houston and reported on George Floyd's neighborhood, Third Ward. While not reporting or editing, she taught journalism classes at the University of Houston, received her master's degree from BU, where her work focused on sex workers and the overdose crisis. She also graduated from the University of Florida. You have an amazing resume. Thank you so much for doing this, which now explains why your article so captured me and my imagination. And I wanted people to hear this story that on sort of an arm's length relationship seems like just a small story about some superintendent in Florida. But as I read your story, it really brings together all the pieces of what Ron DeSantis is doing and the consequences of that for educators, for superintendents, for people that believe in free speech, for people that really want their children to be fully educated. And this guy, this superintendent, Rocky Hanna, oh my God, I wish he was my superintendent. So let me welcome you to the program, Anna.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So set the stage for this. For those of us who have not been following everything that Ron DeSantis did and the relationship to a number of superintendents in the state of Florida, I noticed that at one point, a lot of these same superintendents like Rocky Hanna were opposed to what DeSantis did, for example, by banning mask mandates. Here they were trying to keep their kids safe. They knew that they were in the middle of a pandemic. And what you had was a governor who was basically poo-pooing anything that would actually ensure the safety of students and faculty. And then we know what he's doing now with education. So tell me a little bit about the history and a little bit about this guy named Rocky Hanna.
I'll start with Rocky Hanna. Rocky Hanna has worked for Leon County Schools for, 30-something years. He was my principal. So there's that. I grew up in Tallahassee. He became superintendent in 2016. So this is his second term. And he's kind of done everything. He's been a teacher, he's been a vice principal, principal, you know, kind of worked his way up into administration. And he comes from a local Tallahassee family who's been here for decades, generations. Things kind of started going sideways, probably during the Delta surge. And that's when it wasn't just Mr. Hanna who was concerned with the governor's executive order that banned mask mandates in schools. There were a couple other counties too, like Alachua County, that's in Gainesville, Florida. I believe Broward, Miami-Dade, some of the, I guess, bluer counties, right? And so they were targeted after that for defying the governor's mask mandate, or anti-mask mandate, rather. So a couple things happened, like their school boards, their pay was withheld. Rocky Hanna spoke out about that. They could not withhold Rocky Hanna's pay. He's an elected official, but they could withhold the school board members' pay. So they did that in October of 2021. Then, you know, they tried to withhold other funds. That didn't really work out because that was withholding money from teachers, which is a big no-no. But yeah, it just kind of kept going on with that. And
I did a little homework and I found out that there were about 12 superintendents that wanted to defy DeSantis's anti-mask mandate. Of the 12, only five are left standing. Okay. So that's how effective he was in removing these people who defied him. And one is, as you point out, that Rocky Hanna, although he did defy Ron DeSantis, he could not be removed because he's one of a handful, a very small number, who are elected superintendents. Most people are appointed. He is an elected superintendent. So in some ways, the voters is his protection.
There's actually a fair amount of elected superintendents, okay. But in this group of people, he was one of a handful of elected officials. And so he kind of has a little more power that way. He can't really be removed. This latest move by the Department of Education is a way that they can, poke the bear a little bit because they're going to go after his teaching certificate because you saw that it's the Office of Professional Practice.
Let's explain, what is it that he did that so offended people at the state level that now he's under investigation? Because I also saw something very interesting, and it may have been in your story or another story I read, that there's a connection between Moms for Liberty and Rocky Hanna and the fact that he's now being investigated to be removed and have maybe his credentials removed. And again, my audience knows a little bit about Moms for Liberty, and it doesn't surprise me that we're seeing this sort of, you know, interesting dance between they show up, they make a complaint, it goes to the board at the state level, and then all of a sudden Rocky Hanna is now being accused and being investigated.
Right. So Rocky Hanna has been pretty outspoken about a lot of the governor's agenda, educational agenda. It's not just masks. It's also about LGBTQ guides. So the Parental Rights in Education Bill, also known as the Don't Say Gay Bill by critics, that was created as a response to a lawsuit here in Leon County. It was a catalyst. Yeah. The lawsuit was a catalyst in the creation of the bill. And then also he's been really outspoken about against school choice vouchers. So we're about to, HB1 was just discussed at a committee meeting last week. It's a huge expansion on school choice vouchers that basically takes public funds and, gives parents the choice to direct those funds to private schools and send their kid to private schools. So he's been outspoken not only in op-eds and Facebook posts, but, you know, when he speaks to the media in interviews with me, right? So this is just kind of the latest, as far as to pinpoint exactly what it is and his personal views, it's hard to pinpoint because I don't have that information. I've done some public records requests. I still have not received those back. As far as the Moms for Liberty goes, in his statement, Rocky Hanna said he believes if the investigation stems from a complaint from a Moms for Liberty member. I cannot confirm that.
Okay.
I cannot see the complaint. I've asked for it. So I will update you when that happens. But that is what Rocky Hanna stated. But I cannot confirm. I have not seen that complaint. So,
so Anna, one of the things I found interesting is that they sort of accuse him of infusing his agenda with his personal views. They don't, though, from my understanding, is they don't give anything specific. No. They just make this sort of broad generalization. We think that you are doing with your personal views. Really? Like, which personal views? Give me some point in time. Tell me exactly what you're doing. To do this, to threaten him with something so obtuse, with no information at your fingertips, how could they even do it? I mean, it's clearly nothing more than this grotesque threat with no real substance to support it. And yet look what they're doing in Leon County. And if they do it there, you know, they're doing it not just to him, but the threat is going out to every other superintendent in the state. This is what we'll do. But the fact that there's nothing specific there says how specious this is.
Yeah, this isn't the first time the administration has done this, though. I don't know if you saw what happened to the district attorney in Hillsborough County.
Oh, yes, he was removed.
Yes. So the judge actually, he dismissed the case because the district attorney sued, but he wrote some pretty harsh words to DeSantis, saying that DeSantis broke the law, both state and federal law. However, you know, we'll see. I don't know. I think I wrote in my story, you know, these are the things it could be, right? Because it doesn't really point out exactly what it is. And I don't know if there's a precedence for investigating an educator for personal views. I don't know if there's a precedence. This might be the first time. I'm not sure.
So let me read from your article. So they were talking about the fact that, you know, what is happening here is that this investigation is, quote, harassment and intimidation. I'm just really worried we're going down a dark path on treading on people's freedom of speech, Wood said. Nicholas said he read the email, and the disconnect between Hannah's personal views and those of his educational institution aren't clearly outlined. He writes, in order to accuse someone of a violation, there has to be evidence to say, here's the rule, here's the violation. That's how society operates. There has not been that transaction. And so that it is concerning, because using the logic that has been used thus far, you can then accuse anyone of anything. Now, I think that's the whole point, Anna. I think that's the whole point. Let me just read that sentence again, because I just want people, there's a book called On Tyranny by a Yale professor. And this is exactly one of the things he says you see when people are experiencing tyranny, is that there's these veiled threats that are obtuse. You're supposed to then start figuring out exactly what they mean. Anna, you even sort of fell into that rabbit hole because you were trying to figure out exactly what they could be accusing them of. That's not your job. Their job is to tell you, but look what they're doing. Anna's trying to figure out what it is. The threat goes out there. Everyone's beginning to say, what did I say? What did I do? That's not what is supposed to happen. If you accuse someone of someone, you give them the evidence of that accusation. But look what this is. This is, you know, blue smoke and mirrors all the time. But that's exactly what they want to do, because it chills everyone from doing anything they think might offend them. Am I right here? I mean, I read this, and I just want to read something over and over again. There has not been that transaction, so that is concerning. Before using the logic that has been used thus far, you can accuse anyone of anything. That should be the headline. And that's what's so terrifying, Anna.
Yeah, I as a reporter, you know, my job is to find the truth. My job is to figure out what's going on. And in this case, I know that there's something going on. I'm just kind of trying to figure out exactly what. So in the first story, like you mentioned, it kind of laid out, could be masks, could be the LGBTQ guide, could be school choice, right? Or, you know, the school board members that you quoted, Roseanne Wood and Marcus Nicholas, they're supporters of Rocky Hanna. So, you know, there are people on the school board who don't support him and who believe that he is, you know, antagonizing the state government, antagonizing, you know, the power.
So what would they think he's antagonizing? So what would those people like him to do? How far does he have to genuflect? What ring does he have to kiss? He's an elected superintendent, unlike an appointed superintendent. People knew who he was. He's been there for nearly 40 years. They've seen him in every aspect of their lives. They understand that he's there to protect teachers and to protect students. I mean, I love the letter that he sent to his teachers, basically at the very beginning of the academic year, which said something, I posted it on my Facebook page. Everyone, go to my Facebook page and read this letter from the superintendent. And as I said to Anna, after I read this letter, every school district deserves a superintendent like this, because he said, I have your back. I want you to teach. That's what I want you to do. I want you to teach. And again, it's like be who you are, which are educators. And up until Ron DeSantis, no one thought that what they were teaching was threatening. No one thought that what they were doing was, you know, against some agenda. And yet all of a sudden DeSantis comes in and all of a sudden all those teachers are now suspect. Doesn't that say something to you, Anna, that, you know, 3 years ago, that wasn't the case. And all of a sudden now DeSantis suddenly says, look at what you're doing. And you're trying to figure out, what have I done different?
Well, the Moms for Liberty, they've definitely mobilized, and they do have a pretty big following here in Florida. They had a big conference down, I think, in Central Florida. Here in Tallahassee, I believe they have 60 members. There are about 32,000 students in Leon County schools. So 60 members, 32,000 schools. It's not as, you know, prevalent as it is in other counties, maybe. I'm not really sure because I haven't checked those numbers. But there are, you know, you said like, you know, before this, there were no problems. You know, I don't know. Like, I think they've been able to capitalize on a lot of worries that these parents' rights that are now becoming federal laws, right? You have other people trying to file bills, trying to file a federal parents' bill of rights, right? They have a lot of power.
They do.
They're at every meeting. They're at every, you know, board of governors meeting. They're there and they mobilize and they communicate. And
but I feel like they're handmaidens to DeSantis. So let me explain to you. So we're in the same place in some ways in New Hampshire as you are in Florida. Mm-hmm. So we're also looking at expanding these school vouchers. Now we know right now they're up to $78,000 a year. They're looking at expanding mm-hmm. it to maybe $150,000 a year, maybe even taking off the cap. You can use mm-hmm. the money from public education for homeschooling, for private schooling, for parochial schools. Obviously, it is a war on public education. They are trying to break the back of public education. And what is so interesting to me, as you look at Moms for Liberty, which organized originally, I believe, in Florida. I think they're originally from Florida. So you know that the money and the relationship with DeSantis is probably pretty similar. And so they become like the handmaiden for DeSantis. DeSantis wants something, so they make sure they agitate for this. In my state of New Hampshire, we have something called Americans for Prosperity, which is a Koch brother group. What does the Koch brother group do? They passed this expansive voucher bill. They said, only a couple of dozen parents will figure it out. That's all that'll happen. It'll be $100,000. Well, we're up to about $10 million now. And why? Because Americans for Prosperity marketed the vouchers, knocked on people's doors, sold it to homeschoolers, and all of a sudden people who would never have known about it, who might not even have exercised the option, were encouraged by this Koch brother group to actually embrace it. And now it's hemorrhaging millions of dollars out of our public education system. So I have to look at the behavior in my state, then look at the behavior in Florida and going, there's something suspicious here, because they're not just acting as governors or acting as, you know, commissioners of education. They have people working with them, and the people that are working with them are getting underwritten by some toxic groups, and their agenda is anti-public education.
Yes, I think I will agree with you in that Moms for Liberty do. So whenever they bring out parents, right, at these press conferences, Moms for Liberty definitely is there.
Yes.
They're there, and they're like, you know, they're the parent spokesperson for whatever thing that DeSantis is trying to, you know, trying to explain, trying to tout his new thing.
It's scary. It's scary because they're so well funded. In some ways, it's happening sort of under the radar. It feels a little clandestine. They're working with a governor who has a political agenda because he wants to run for president. They're going to use the schools as their poster child. And then you've got a guy like Rocky Hanna. Anna, is it okay if I just read a couple of sentences from his letter to his faculty? Because I want people to hear this, because I'm the daughter of two school teachers. I ran for governor on the whole issue of education. Okay, so you need to know this is like personal for me in a lot of ways. But this is what this guy said. He said, "It's hard for me to believe that I'm about to enter my 34th year with Leon County Schools. As in years in the past, I find myself nervous and excited to start." But then let me just sort of go on. He goes, having said this, and he talks about the agendas and political careers and what's happening. He said, "Let me be clear about one thing. I will always have your back." This is what he's writing to his teachers. "I realize that this is improper grammar, but you do you. Continue to teach the standards, just as you always have done. Do not worry for 1 minute about naysayers, political, and others who are trying to mislead people and control what you can and cannot say in your classrooms. If someone wants to come after you, they will have to go through us and our attorneys. Whether you are a member of the union or not, you are covered by a professional liability policy. We will advocate for you. We will defend you. In addition, no matter what some people may try to convince you to believe with misinformation and divisive intentions, I value you more than you will ever know. And I have the utmost respect for what you do every single day in your classroom to help our children, your students, succeed in life. Even with the negative distractions, we are in the best profession ever. I hope each of you have an amazing school year. That's how he started. I'm crying, Anna. Mm-hmm. That's how he started in the fall. And now look what's happening. He's being investigated about some obtuse accusations that are nonspecific about his personal opinion. What's DeSantis's personal opinion? How has that infected his governing? What does he do when he defines woke? What does he mean when he says free speech? What does he believe in when it comes to public education? He's smart. He went to Yale. He went to Harvard Law School. I want to know how his personal beliefs have infected everything he does. And yet this is the superintendent he's accusing it of. It breaks my heart, to be honest with you, because those are the kinds of educators you want in your schools, and yet he's being so threatened.
Well, I think all we can do right now is just, I think this was the first layer of the onion, right?
So
as far as this story goes, this is as far as I've gotten. I'm sure as time goes on, I'll find out more and I'll report and I'll do my thing, right?
Yeah.
And we'll have more context as to what is, what's truly happening behind the scenes. A lot of it is speculation right now. And I don't like to assume. I follow too, as you said, I used to teach journalism and I still do teach journalism. But I tell students two rules. One, always ask questions, and two, never assume.
Yeah.
And so with this story, this isn't just one and done.
No, of course not.
Something I'll be keeping my eye on, especially since it is such a he's quite a figure here in town, in Tallahassee, which is the capital of Florida. So
right. And so there are so many reasons why I wanted everyone to hear this story, because these are the kinds of educators they're driving out. This is the goal. If you're good at your job, then you can't be in your job. Because if there's a war on public education, and I want people to realize all these personal views that we don't even know what they're accusing him of. If you go into a homeschool setting, it's all personal views. If you go into a private school setting, it's all their private agenda. If you go into parochial schools, it's their Christian, Muslim, Jewish, whatever their agenda is. So in a lot of ways, it's not really about your personal views, because they want to use public dollars for homeschoolers' personal views. They want to use public dollars for religious personal views. It is not about views. It is about undermining public education. Because if views were a concern, then where they would send those dollars with no oversight would not be to parochial schools, private schools, and homeschools, because they would be concerned about how those public dollars are being used. But they don't care, because they're breaking the back of public education. It's an excellent piece, Anna. I will follow you. Please share this. As you pointed out, we're peeling the onion, and Tallahassee is going to be an important place for us to focus on, because it's where DeSantis does his damage and does his work. He is the governor of Florida, and he has his eye on running for president. And I just want to remind everyone that not only is he running for president, whether he is or not, but Donald Trump was in New Hampshire on Saturday giving his first speech as a candidate for president. And at that annual meeting of the Republican Party in New Hampshire, there were two groups raising and collecting signatures for Ron DeSantis. Supposedly, they're not approved by Ron, but if nothing else, guess what? They were collecting those signatures at the Republican event on Saturday, and that made Donald Trump a very unhappy camper. Anna Gonalesson has written a piece entitled "School Board Reacts with Mixed Feelings About Department of Education Investigation into Superintendent Hanna." Hanna is under a, quote, preliminary investigation, close quote, by the State Education Department for allegedly infusing personal views into his work as the head of the school district. We don't know what those personal views are, but I'm sure Anna will figure it out for us once they figure it out for themselves. Thank you so much for doing this. I really, really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks so much, and hope you're staying warm up there,
Oh,
because
we are.
I
It's
will lose
lovely. You can have all the heat you want in Florida. I'm a happy camper here. And on that note, this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Dave Scott and Steph Collins. Stick around, folks. We'll be right back.
James Whitey Bulger, an organized crime kingpin in Boston for decades, extorted, tortured, and murdered people.
I'm criminal defense attorney Luke Ryan, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute with ACLU attorney Bill Newman.
After an FBI agent gave Bulger a heads up about his imminent indictment in 1994, Bulger skipped town and lived on the lam until his arrest in 2011, after which he was tried, convicted, and sentenced to two life terms plus 5 years. Bulger's FBI handler helped him because Bulger also was an FBI informant. And in prison, informants can be in deep trouble. Indeed, when Bulger was transferred to the Hazleton, West Virginia Penitentiary in 2018, where known enemies of his were doing time, inmates placed bets on how long he would survive, which wasn't long. Within hours of his arrival, he was bludgeoned to death. The recent Inspector General's report says that Bulger, who is a frail 89-year-old in a wheelchair, should never have been transferred to that prison and never placed in general population there. Never, not even close. Prison authorities knew that Bulger, an obviously in many ways atypical inmate, would receive enormous publicity if something happened to him. Which raises the bigger question. How much attention do we pay to the safety and health of the not famous more than 2 million people locked up in American prisons and jails today?
The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU because, as the criminal legal system proves every day, freedom can't protect itself.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When indefinite detention is the new reality. For so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps, not used since the war. Where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors. When they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses. You've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Between me together is reality.
Welcome back to part two of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. And of course, we continue to record on Monday morning. So you know I love the Christian Science Monitor. My dad was reading it to me when I was 2 years old, and now I'm 69 and I'm still reading that sucker. Joining us right now is Linda Feldman. She is the Christian Science Monitor's Washington Bureau Chief, host of the Monitor Breakfast, and a senior political and White House correspondent. She has covered every presidential election since 1996. Previous positions at the Monitor include Moscow Bureau Chief, op-ed editor, foreign affairs writer. Anyway, she's covered the gamut. Since 2015, she's been a delegate to the Dartmouth Conference, the U.S.-Russian Citizens Diplomacy Initiative. In 1999, she won an Exceptional Merit Media Award and the National Women's Political Caucus for her series, Where Women Stand. In 1987, she worked at a Russian newspaper, the Moscow News, for 3 months as part of the first U.S.-Soviet journalist exchange. Why did I reach out to Linda Feldman? because Linda had written a piece, very short. She was mostly sort of just sort of wetting our whistle and letting us know what she was paying attention to. And it was entitled, Rona McDaniel or Harmeet Dhillon, Why I'm Glued to the RNC Race. So let me welcome Linda to the program. Thank you so much for joining me, Linda.
Hi, good to be here.
So actually, let me just touch something. I'm going to go back to your bio for a second, because we have a little tiny bit in common. So at the very end of your bio, it mentions the fact that for 3 months you were working for a Russian newspaper. God, in 1987, how the world has changed, as part of a U.S.-Soviet journalist exchange. So you need to know what I did maybe about 12 years ago, I guess. There was an exchange with New Hampshire with a group of lawyers and people working for government, with lawyers and Russian folks working for government. And so they had gone over to Russia, and then they had a group of them coming over to New Hampshire. And so they asked me if two of them could stay with me. And the two that were going to stay with me were sort of like social workers in Russia. And they didn't speak a word of English, and I didn't speak a word of Russian. One was kind of large and plumpy, and the other one looked like Marilyn Monroe. I mean, she was drop dead Marilyn. I mean, blonde hair, voluptuous. Anyway, but they didn't speak any English, but I could like type in my computer and do a translation. So at least that way I could have some kind of a communication with them. And I wasn't sure what they thought after their week and a half of staying with me and what their experience was, but I was trying to be as charming and as, you know, welcoming as possible. As they were leaving, they left, and all of a sudden they knocked on the door, and the one that looked just like Marilyn Monroe opens the door, and she looks at me and she says, Arnie number one. And I realized, well, if nothing else, I had done a good job. And she was in Putin's party. So, you know, I'm telling you. So I just want to let you know, but that was so many years ago. And now look at what's happened with our relationship with Russia. Look at our relationship with China. I'm like so, so terrified. And I'm not even sure where the GOP stands on any of those issues, because Donald Trump doesn't give a crap. You know, it's whatever sort of serves his purpose. Talk to us a little bit about what happened this last week, because I was following Donald Trump's first real political event in New Hampshire on Saturday, but you were watching this interesting race for the RNC. So tell me a little bit about Rona McDaniel and about Harmeet Dhillon. I didn't know who Harmeet Dhillon was from a hole in the wall until I read your piece, but I think people need to know who they are and why this was such an interesting thing to watch, although what was predicted ultimately happened.
So Rona McDaniel, they're both very interesting characters. I've known Rona for several years. The first thing to know is that she's a Romney, as in Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney is her uncle. So she used to go by Rona Romney McDaniel. But then when she became aligned with Donald Trump, she dropped the Romney, I think, at his mild suggestion. I've had Rona appear at Monitor Breakfast and have brought up the Romney connection, and she made it clear that it's a big family. She does not have Thanksgiving dinners with Mitt Romney. I think some obvious tension there, but I think they just don't talk to each other, and not because they're estranged in some way, but they're clearly in different wings of the Republican Party. I mean, Mitt Romney is essentially a never Trumper, and Rona McDaniel is tied to Trump, but not fully. I wouldn't say she's ultra MAGA. I would say she's MAGA adjacent and wants to represent all wings of the party, which is why, just to bring it back to today, which is why Donald Trump actually did not issue an endorsement in this race for RNC chair last Friday. That was, I think, by mutual agreement with Rona McDaniel. He's self-aware enough to know that that could have hurt her. And even though Harmeet Dhillon, who was a campaign lawyer for Donald Trump during the 2020 election and in the aftermath, more importantly, she is ultra MAGA. So you might think, well, he's more in line with her, but not really. I think Donald Trump knows that he needs to get the Republican base really back in his corner. And he doesn't have that at the moment. I'd say that the typical Republican response to Donald Trump is, I liked his policies, but I don't want him to run for president again. I think we need new blood.
before we leave the former Romney, who doesn't use the word Romney anymore in her name,
right?
And she said it's a big family. Oh God, they're Mormons. Of course, it's a big family. They probably could like fill a state. But when you said it's a big family, I almost wet my pants. I'm laughing so hard. What was her political rise? Like, what was the ladder she used to become the chair of the Republican National Committee? I mean, that's not like a small position. I mean, you have the chair of a county.
Exactly.
You're the chair of the National Republican Party. So I just kind of need to know, while she may have been willing to drop the Romney name, obviously Romney may have been useful for her at some point in time, but who the hell was she before she became the RNC chairperson? Because, you know, again, I didn't know her, but I did know she had a Romney name and then she didn't have a Romney name. That's the extent of my knowledge.
She's from Michigan, as is Mitt Romney originally. Mitt Romney's brother, Scott, is her father, to close that loop. She was chair of the Michigan Republican Party for the 2016 election, and she was helpful in getting Donald Trump elected. She helped Donald Trump win Michigan in 2016. In that effort, she caught his attention. And when Donald Trump decided to make Reince Priebus, in the 2016 election, Reince Priebus was chair of the RNC. He made Reince the chief of staff. And then he effectively elevated Ronna McDaniel to be chair of the RNC. When a president wins the presidency, he, and it's always been he, always gets to basically put forth their person to become chair of the Republican National Committee. And that's what happened in this case.
I mean, again, Donald Trump is so clever. It's not just that she helped him win Michigan. He was kind of like flexing his muscle with Mitt Romney, because in a lot of ways he liked the location, Romney. He liked the name, Romney, and he liked a Romney in his pocket, not in Mitt's pocket. So, I mean, you know how Donald Trump is. He's a jerk. And this is kind of a way to enhance his jerkiness. But again, she had credentials. She was, you know, the chair of the Michigan Republican Party. It did win. It sucked in the last election. I mean, Michigan went the incredible opposite direction. So I'm not surprised he didn't endorse her this time. But here's the part that I am totally confused by. So you mentioned that the woman that Ronna was running against, or whatever her name is a woman named Ms. Dillon. Now, you said that Ms. Dillon worked for Donald Trump as Trump's former lawyer. And yet you would assume that, you know, she's real MAGA, but real MAGA not only did not get endorsed by Donald Trump, but got endorsed by Governor DeSantis. And this is kind of a wimpy endorsement, because Ron DeSantis didn't endorse her sort of at the beginning. It was kind of like a wimpy, I'm with her, like 24 hours before the election. And I'm not sure that she could use it to her effect. And it turned out that she was not able to sort of use Ron's endorsement. But if nothing else, it was a way to be prickly with Donald Trump.
Absolutely. That was totally what that was about.
Yes.
Harmeet Dillon was very much a long shot. Ronna McDaniel has a very warm personality. People like her. She's great at fundraising. She gets how to run a party. She's a mom, which shouldn't be relevant, but she knows how to organize people, right?
Okay, yep.
Harmeet Dillon never smiles. I mean, if you ever watch conservative TV like Fox or Newsmax, Harmeet Dillon is on all the time, and she never smiles, which shouldn't matter. But it does. People just don't warm up to her, because
she's perfect for Ron DeSantis.
Warm.
Ron DeSantis doesn't smile. Ron DeSantis doesn't like people. I mean, my God, they should marry each other. It's like so perfect. But how did Dillon and DeSantis even get together? And what was the calling card for Harmeet Dillon that she thought that she should do this? I mean, she couldn't out MAGA the current RNC chair, but at the same time, she was trying to both out MAGA her and bring in new blood with DeSantis. Like, she was trying to thread this interesting needle.
Right. So here's the other key thing to know.
Okay.
The Republicans have had three quote unquote bad cycles in a row. So in 2018, they had the bad midterm election where they lost the House. In 2020, Trump lost the presidency, and both houses of, you know, the Democrats kept both houses of Congress. So Joe Biden takes office with everything. And then in 22, the Republicans way underperformed. So, yes, they did take over the House, but they didn't take the Senate. It was seen as a bad cycle for the Republicans, as a big opportunity that was lost. And the party chair is an obvious person to blame for that. Whether Ronna McDaniel is to blame is another debate, but an easy. So Harmeet Dhillon and Ron DeSantis both said, we need a change at the top, a change in party leader, because we've had three bad cycles in a row.
So let me just remind everyone that the 2022 cycle was worse than you think. And the reason is, and you know this too, Linda, is that what do we know about 2020? 2020 was the year of redistricting. It's when you get to gerrymander the hell out of everything. And now that the Supreme Court has basically embraced the idea of partisan gerrymandering, people, it was like a Republican wet dream. They were like, oh my God, look at how we can carve up these districts. They're going to look like a salamander. They're going to look like a snake. And so they were able, think about this, they were able we're in a pandemic, we're on the verge of inflation, we're going to war in Ukraine, we got an old guy named Biden as president. I mean, you can't make the crap up. And then they've got these incredible gerrymandered districts. And despite all those opportunities, it isn't just that they lost the Senate, because the Senate you can't gerrymander, but the House was gerrymandered to hell, even in And when you look at that and realize that they barely won, and frankly, the only reason why they won is New York screwed up and so did California.
Right.
So, you know, the two bluest states on the planet. What did she say to them? Did she blame Donald Trump? Because she doesn't want to blame herself.
No.
So what did she say was the reason why they so screwed up in 2022?
The argument is just that the party didn't do a good enough job of turning out its voters. That is the key. And you know, you can also argue that Democrats did a lousy job at turning out votes, especially in places like Florida. Florida is a complete disaster in terms of Democratic organization. So Rana can argue that the national party chair can do its part. She raised buckets of money and she, you know, traveled the country to kind of get people excited and enthusiastic. She's a good cheerleader for the party. But as you suggested in your introduction, national party leaders don't have the power that they used to. They don't select the candidates. So she can promise her best effort, but she can't promise the moon.
And let me just, you made a statement, and you don't follow me on Facebook, but you should, Linda, because just the other day, 14 hours ago, in fact, this is what I posted on my Facebook page, everyone. How did Ron DeSantis win re-election last year by 20 points? Sit down, everyone, because this actually emphasizes exactly what Linda Feldman just said. Democratic turnout in Florida plummeted by 20 points compared to 2018, while GOP turnout increased. So this is what DeSantis is able to sell. I can deflate the Democrats and I can excite the Republicans. And as you point out, that's exactly why DeSantis won. He didn't win because people liked him. He won because the Democrats basically went, I'm staying home. Why? Because the Democratic candidate was a former Republican. And that was such a joke, you know? So it's just to me so interesting to sort of see what this stuff happens with. It's just unbelievable. Even though she's in a position where she can fundraise, it'll be fascinating to see how Donald Trump sort of responds to her leadership, or what kind of control he's going to have over her leadership. I guess that's the other question. Now that we know that he's running for president again, is he in some ways castrating himself because then he has less control over what the RNC chairman does?
So he doesn't. He's never had full control. But Ronna McDaniel's challenge will be to be an honest broker for all the candidates.
Okay.
It may well not be in the Republican Party's interest for Donald Trump to be their nominee. And I think she knows that. And so you're going to have a lot of candidates running against Trump. And she needs to be seen as playing fair and square with all of them, whether it's Ron DeSantis or Mike Pompeo or Nikki Haley or Donald Trump. So while she and Trump have this good connection, she can't be seen as Trump's party chair.
All right. So I just, again, want to let everyone know that Donald Trump did show up in the state of New Hampshire, did show up in the state of South Carolina. But one of my favorite headlines, which I thought was absolutely hilarious because I think in some ways it nailed it, is the headline from Time Magazine. Trump delivers bitter speech filled with falsehoods in New Hampshire. I'm like, well, there's a selling point for you. But one of the things that was also fascinating, I don't know if you knew this, but so he gives a speech. It's like, you know, you could predict exactly what he's going to do. He basically claims that he won New Hampshire when, in fact, he lost New Hampshire in 2016. He lost New Hampshire in 2020. But I think he was referring to the primary, like anybody remembers that. Somehow winning the primary is not the same as winning the state. But here's what's also fascinating. The two-term New Hampshire GOP GOP chairman, then endorsed Donald Trump and went on to become like a supporter of Trump. So right after he steps down as chairperson of the New Hampshire GOP, he announces that he's going to work for Donald Trump. And of course, Donald loves that because it looks like his power and control over New Hampshire. But what I will share with you, Linda, having lived in New Hampshire and covering presidential campaigns for way too long, there is no human being in New Hampshire that has any sway over any voter. I mean, a governor could say, vote for this person, and they go like hell. Mm-hmm. A U.S. senator, whether right. it's Jean Shaheen or Maggie Hassan, could endorse someone that has absolutely, let me repeat this, absolutely no influence on a single mm-hmm. voter in New Hampshire. So he could like put it in his belt and notch it saying, I've got this former GOP chairman, but I think it doesn't have any meaning. So before I let you go, though, I want to talk a little bit about classified documents, because it wasn't mm-hmm. until I read your article about classified documents that I read something that was kind of shocking to a large extent. And I believe it was in your article, but we know that there are way too many of them. We know that like mm-hmm. everything on their uncle is classified. We know that, you know, if you're a senator, you have to go into a skiff. But when you're a president or a vice president, your office is the skiff. So therefore, you're not mm-hmm. going anywhere, and it's sitting on your desk, and who knows whether you've checked mm-hmm. it in or checked it out. So I think that's really important. But I think what's so fascinating to me is that there are so many pieces of paper that are now considered classified or something else that they've stopped counting them. They stopped yeah. recording them because it's a tsunami of papers. If they've stopped counting them, then guess what, Linda? They have no freaking clue.
It's really sad, and it's kind yeah. of frightening. As I forget who said this in my story. If everything's classified, here it is. Classified.
Right. Well, you have this. You said Mark Eisenhower? Bradley. Mark, no, yeah, that was Eisenhower. But Mark Bradley, director of the Information Security Oversight Office, reported yeah. last July that his office has stopped, listen to this, has stopped mm-hmm. trying to count annual production of government secrets. Quote, we can no longer keep our heads above the tsunami. Now, if they can't keep mm-hmm. count, then guess what? Who mm-hmm. knows what's in and who knows what's out? Am I right?
That's true. But yes, no, completely agree. And there needs to be reform for this whole process of both yeah. classification and then dealing with the documents. But that doesn't really get to the question of how did Donald Trump and Joe Biden and Mike Pence and who knows who else wind up with classified documents in their houses and in Biden's case in his office. There just needs to be a better system for tracking the documents that do cross people's desks.
Some of the documents they found, so with Donald Trump, they just brought in a moving van and just moved boxes. I mean, he was just, right. he was over the top, okay? Like Donald Trump does everything. And then he says, I didn't know they were there. They were like, in your desk with your passport. Come on. You know, I mean, he's not even, I mean, he's such a funny liar. You know what I mean? And you kind of look, all I said to someone, this is what I would do. I would put all the documents that were taken out of Donald Trump's office and put them on a desk. And then I would have a desk right next to that. And then I'd have all the documents they found in Joe Biden's offices. So one would be about maybe 7 inches thick. The other one would be feet. Okay. Just to say, you know, I understand they both took stuff, but come on. But more importantly, here's the question that no one's answered. And maybe Linda, you can do this. Again, we're talking with Linda Feldman from the Christian Science Monitor. So Linda, they found documents from when he was a state senator, well, U.S. senator. Okay.
U.S. Senator.
U.S. Senator, right, because he was never. And I'm so, yeah. first of all, that's a long time ago, number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, mm-hmm. when did they know that those documents were not returned? Number three, he would have been in a skiff. Let me just remind everyone, he would not have been in his mm-hmm. office. That they would find these documents are so old, they could be in the Smithsonian. I mean, they're just right. such old documents. But that also tells you they've never really kept track, ever.
Right. I mean, in this business of the National Archives, noticing that documents are missing, they're obviously not noticing all missing documents. They're just noticing in important cases, which was the case with Donald Trump. But with, I'm afraid I really can't answer your question on how yeah. this could have happened. Yeah. And that's why we have a special counsel. I'm hoping that he is doing an investigation, and I'm hoping that we can get some answers from him as to how a U.S. senator, any U.S. senator, I mean, who knew that he would eventually become vice president and president, but that those documents, you know, wind up in his personal possession and were there for years.
I posted something right after they found the documents in Joe Biden's, I don't know, next to his Corvette or whatever the car he's driving. And so everyone's like, oh, Arnie. So I said, here's what I'd like to do. I want Dick Cheney, and I want Barack Obama, and I want George Bush, and I want Bill Clinton to invite everyone into their offices to find documents. Because I have a funny feeling that, you know what, this is not a one-off. You know, given what I'm reading in your article, given what I'm seeing going on, it just sounds like we're just so incredibly sloppy. And yet what is amazing to me is look at the material that we're sloppy with. Since everything in their uncle is classified, I don't know if this is like really important classified or kind of weak classified, or as you say, classified adjacent. So again, if it's a tsunami of material, I don't even know whether to get worried or not, because I think they overclassify everything to start. So I am kind of looking at this, and I guess I'm going to leave with this, Linda. So as we know, the title of the article, everyone, at the Christian Science Monitor by Linda Feldman, is Classified Documents Seem to Be Everywhere. Is there a solution? And so here's my question to you, Linda, and that is, what do they do in France? What do they do in England? What do they do in, like, what do other countries do? They also have to have documents. They also have to classify their documents. What kind of a check-in, check-out do they have? You know, I mean, we don't have to invent the wheel, but at the same time, it seems like it feels like it's arbitrary and capricious. Like, you notice when you notice, and then you don't notice when you don't notice. And that's not good for a democracy.
Exactly. You're asking many excellent questions that I can't answer. I love the international part, but can I just say one thing? In this day and age, when we have so much sophisticated technology, why are we even still dealing with pieces of paper? There has to be an electronic way for people to view and access, people who have the proper clearances, including the president, vice president, et cetera, to view what they need to see without having pieces of paper that might wind up in a box in their garage someday. I'm just saying.
No. Well, Linda, so I'm going to just say something back to you. And that is that now there's a concern about hacking. And one of the things that we find interesting about the fact that Donald Trump doesn't really do emails, he doesn't really do all this stuff, he doesn't want a record. So therefore, he can deny, because everything now is digitized. And we assume that we can find lots of stuff. We can go to his profile here and his profile there. Well, he manages to sort of erase his fingerprints off of everything. And the beauty of a piece of paper is that, you know, you can find it and then you can refile it, but you can't hack it. You know, and I think that's another reason why there's an asset to digitizing everything, but there's also a liability. And now we're finding out that we are so good at getting into this information pile that sometimes what is old is new again. I keep telling my friends, just send me a letter with a stamp. Okay, send me a letter. The stamp is very sexy for me, because I would prefer that than having you do something by the internet. But there are a lot of questions. And the reason I'm sort of imposing them to you is I know you don't have the answer. That's the point. The point is, not only does Linda Feldman not have the answer, but we don't have the answer. And the fact that we've gone so long without asking these questions, I do have to say, to some extent, I think you will agree with me, Donald Trump's over the top, you know, absconding of all these documents was a gift, because it showed once again that what is a norm isn't effective, that it's like a piece of Swiss cheese, and we really have no accountability. And you don't want to be that vulnerable, especially in such a challenging time where norms really, they don't hold up anymore. And you don't want to feel good about them. I mean, if you think Donald Trump violated the norms, I can't wait till Ron DeSantis does, because he's much smarter. You know, he's gonna be really effective at making sure of it. Again, Linda Feldman is a staff writer at the Christian Science Monitor. She joined us to talk about that interesting chairmanship race for the Republican Party. And then I had to grab her about her piece entitled Classified Documents Seem to Be Everywhere. Is there a solution? I don't know, Linda. I'm not quite sure there is. The Monitor's Washington Bureau Chief and host of the Monitor Breakfast. Thank you so much for doing this and putting up with my obnoxious questions.
Sure. Good to be with you, Arnie. Appreciate it.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Linda. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. I'm producer Dave Scott, Stephanie Collins. We will schmooze tomorrow, everyone. Ciao. You better think-